1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3.
You are listening to
In the Public Interest.
On KTSW.
San Marcos.
San Marcos.
Hey, you guys, my name is Malcolm Gibbs, and I'm one of the new hosts for In the Public Interest this semester at Texas State.
And my name is Judith Beto, another new host for IPI.
All right, so let's just get straight into it. Last week, our co-hosts, Carmen and Mark, they talked to you guys about Valentine's Day and also gave us a quick rundown on dating apps like Tinder and Grindr, and also talked about different dating websites like OkCupid. Judith, do you ever check out any of these apps?
No.
Okay, well, maybe you're doing better than some of us. Did you do anything for Valentine's Day?
Yeah, I went to see a movie and had dinner with a friend.
Okay, that's cool. Well, my Valentine's Day was pretty lonely. I didn't really do much. I'm single, so I actually went to the movies as well. I saw The Kingsman and 50 Shades of Grey. Honestly, both of them were really good. The Kingsman was awesome. It's a good spy film, you know, classic Samuel Jackson in there, but... Anyways, we'll be talking about a couple of different things today, including different racial issues that affect students' abilities to pledge for different fraternities and sororities, different racial divisions in the Greek life community, and we'll also be taking a look at the current relationship between students and the San Marcos Police Department, as well as taking a trip over to the Calaboose African Museum that just reopened up here in San Marcos. Before we send it over to our reporter, Jacqueline Carter, let me just ask you, have you ever noticed any racial divisions within the fraternities and sororities on campus?
Indeed, I have. I mean, just walking to the quad, you see all these sororities and fraternities, and mostly it is one race.
I don't know. I don't think it's weird to see that a fraternity or a sorority is one race, because honestly, that's how a lot of these fraternities and sororities got started. A lot of these white fraternities, they've always been historically white fraternities. A lot of the historically black fraternities and sororities, they were started as like a safe place, a safe haven for African-American students to go to get away from other people that were not, I guess, welcoming to them and not very inviting in their campus life. So I don't think it's wrong that they're still mostly African-American populated or mostly white populated, because it makes sense. That's what they were based off of. But I do think it's wrong when they get to a point where they won't let you pledge and they won't even give you the right to, I don't know, it's not try out, but but I mean, like, you know, to try and join this Greek life organization.
Yeah, it's definitely something to talk about.
But there are some positives to being in a fraternity or in a sorority. I mean, it gives you that whole circle of, I guess, friendship. Like, you don't ever have to go out and look for friends. You live with these dudes. They're right there in your house or right down the hall, right across the hall. You also get a lot of networking opportunities out of it once you are done with school. I know a lot of people, who have graduated, they say because of they pledged and they were in this fraternity, they were able to get internships like it was nothing. But 12 out of 19 of the presidents in the 20th and the 21st century pledged. That's a lot of people. 63% of White House cabinet members pledged from 1905 to 2010. 63% of them were in frats. But I mean, along with the frats and sororities, obviously they have some like negative stereotypes about them, like the partying and all the, I guess, the sexual abuse cases and everything, and like how they're doing at Dartmouth College, they're actually starting to crack down more on the whole. Actually, they're stopping pledging altogether. You can no longer pledge for Greek life organizations, and they're also putting a hard ban on liquor.
Wow, that is interesting. I hadn't heard about that.
Well, they're doing it so they can like fight against just different alcohol cases, different underage drinking situations, different sexual assault cases, just unnecessary things.
Yes, and also I guess they're just worried about the hazing that may go on.
I've heard a couple stories about hazing, but I also feel like most people are very hush about hazing because if word gets out, then they're in trouble. Like the kid who did, like that freshman, his name was Nolan Birch. He was at West Virginia University, and he was just found unconscious in the frat house after just a night, I guess, of hazing. And he was unconscious, and after 2 days, he actually just died from trauma.
That is very sad to hear that that goes on when rushing for a sorority or fraternity.
So right here at Texas State, we have a bunch of Greek life organizations. Within the Interfraternity Council, which is all, I guess, historically white Greek life groups, we have about 14 of those. And then in the Multicultural Greek Council, we have 8. So honestly, I feel like people have a lot of choices here at Texas State. If there's one Greek life organization that's not giving you a fair opportunity, then you have a lot of others. But I still understand that it's not fair to those if you can't join a Greek life organization based off your race. I mean, obviously, you don't choose what race you are, but you can choose what Greek life group you choose to become a part of. And honestly, I wouldn't want to be a part of any group that didn't want me anyways. If you didn't like me the way I was, I wouldn't want to come and join you and be in your traditions and stuff, because I honestly just wouldn't trust it.
Yeah, I mean, because being in a fraternity or sorority should be about brotherhood and sisterhood. You're supposed to be there for each other no matter what.
So now we'll take it on over to Jacqueline Carter with her story.
Joining a fraternity or sorority is often the peak of many students' social lives in college. Some of the factors that are considered when choosing which Greek organization to join are often legacy traditions and, for others, a higher social status. At Texas State University, Greek organizations are separated into 4 different councils: the Interfraternity Council, the Multicultural Greek Council, the National Panhellenic Council, and the Panhellenic Council. A lot of the councils are predominantly race-populated, except for the Multicultural Greek Council. Some Black individuals are frequently apprehensive on joining what have been sometimes known as predominantly white Greek organizations because of the idea of being labeled as the token Black kid. From an opposite perspective, white individuals claim intimidation is a factor in their choice to join what are known as mostly Black Greek organizations. Due to this separation, people often ask the question, is there a racial divide between Greek organizations on campus? For some members of mostly Black Greek organizations like Robert Fluker, a member of Kappa Alpha Psi Fraternity Incorporated, the difference that separates them is not one dealing with skin color, but a difference on the foundation of the Greek organizations.
I'm a member of Kappa Alpha Psi. Our organization was founded in a very tumultuous time and a very difficult time, and that has echoed throughout our history and up until this point, and it is reflected in our values and traditions. Because of that, I don't know if those same values and traditions are reflected in other Greek-letter organizations, even outside. Not just Black Greek and Hispanic Greek, but all other Greek organizations. I'm not sure if they have that same purpose or that same sense of history or any of those things.
To others, there is also a difference in the longevity of the organizations. Many Greek organizations do not continue after their college career. They are sometimes compared to joining clubs and are no longer an important part of their lives after they graduate, while others are similar to joining a lifetime brother or sisterhood. Cameron Gilmore, a member of the Alpha Phi Alpha Fraternity Incorporated, further explains.
Ours is long-lasting, and it's forever. Like my mother, she went to a conference, and she was at the airport, and they were like, you know what I'm saying, she had her letters on or whatever, and the lady was explaining to her, she was in white sororities or whatever, and she was like, they don't continue after college. Like, once college is over, it's done. We continue after college, just like as a fraternity, we continue after college, and until we die, it's all about service.
On the other side, to the members of a fraternity that is a part of the Interfraternity Council, they say there is not only a racial divide, but a divide between every sector within the respected Greek organizations. The members of this fraternity are willing to share their opinion, but would like to stay anonymous.
We can't speak for other fraternities. We can only speak for ours. Like, yeah. How they feel about it is completely different than how we feel.
We very rarely interact with any other fraternity anyways.
Here, Greek life here is so divided. Yeah. Every most Greek organization hates the other. Like, one fraternity hates the other. It's just competitive.
Having acknowledged the divide, I then asked many of the organizations, do Texas State Greek Affairs encourage interactions between the different Greek organizations? Due to the different councils, many of the Greek organizations are not properly informed about other organizations outside of their council. Council meetings and events are held separately. There is little to no interaction between the councils, which could possibly be the source of the problem. But not all fraternities and sororities feel that way. Members of the multicultural fraternities pride themselves on inclusion. They do not discriminate on race, sexuality, nor gender appearance. Santiago Alaniz, a member of Sigma Lambda Beta International Fraternity Incorporated, says that his fraternity encourages interaction between Greeks, prides themselves on the inclusion of their membership, and being a part of the Multicultural Greek Council.
Especially within MGC, there's no sort of racial divide. We're very multicultural, very diverse. We have brothers, specifically in our chapter, from all different walks of life, all cultures, and there's nothing like that.
Taylor Campbell, a member of Delta Sigma Theta Sorority Incorporated, who is a part of the National Panhellenic Council, does not feel there is a racial divide, but states that her sorority is working on interacting with other councils. Delta Sigma Theta takes pride in inclusion as well as accepting memberships from women regardless of racial backgrounds.
I don't think there's necessarily a divide. I just feel like we don't take the chance to do stuff with each other, and that's why us as Deltas are putting the initiative in to collaborate with the Panhellenic sorority. And I guess so it takes one person to know that they're not so different, and they want to learn about us as much as we want to learn about them. The MPHC as a whole needs to start doing more events with other councils, because if we don't do events with them, I mean, when you're in the quad, you're kind of in your own zone. So you have to reach out and try to, you know, talk to the presidents and stuff like that. That's how you get close to people, is by talking to them.
Although some of the Greek organizations agree there is a racial divide on campus, they are open to making sure that unity between Greek organizations is something that is an idea unanimously executed across the board. Alpha Phi Alpha Fraternity Incorporated member Cameron Gilmore has more insight on creating a more united front.
We need to throw a show together where everybody come out.
It could be a formal, it could be a winter ball formal, it could be anything, you know what I'm saying? But something to just throw together and we collab on something.
For the future, the student body who feels there is a racial divide between Greek organizations on campus, they can only hope that the Greeks are not putting forth a front on agreeing with this idea. They hope Greeks put forth an effort to rid the stereotype as well as interact more to understand one another's Greek life culture.
Thank you, Jacqueline Carter. And now we're going to go on to our next topic, which is the current relationship between San Marcos Police Department and Texas State students. How do you feel about the relationship, Judith?
Well, from what I've seen, it's okay. Like, it's pretty good. I've never seen anyone getting harassed by SMPD. So I would say personally it's a good relationship.
I know. I think people are really just kind of on guard, especially with the current news coverage of all the different teen shootings from different cops and stuff and the police brutality. But honestly, here in San Marcos or here on the Texas State campus, I have never experienced anything that I would feel the need to bring media attention to. I don't think any officer has ever been overly aggressive. I've never seen anyone handle a situation inappropriately. I've always agreed with everyone so far. I don't know. That's just how I feel about it. I'm speaking from my own experience, by the way. I haven't experienced anything out of line. But in addition to that, I also feel like everyone should also know the basic structure of what a police interaction should look like. So for those who are interested, the San Marcos Police Department does offer a Citizen Police Academy. It's a 13-week course, and every week you'll have a 1 3-hour class, and basically you're just going to go over the basic general knowledge that you need, that officers need in order to do their job, including use of force, officer training, DWI procedures, and honestly, the list goes on and on. There's a bunch of stuff that you get to learn that they also have to learn. And once you're completed, you can go into the San Marcos Citizen Police Academy Alumni Association. And basically, they just assist the officers. You can, if there's large scale events, they might call upon you to help out with that. San Marcos, they just started a new program where if residents go out of town, they can have officers do almost like monitor your home for you. So if you're trained for that, you can do all that. And also this training also can lead into other different opportunities that if you're looking maybe for a career change, you can always do that too. But now we're going to send it over to our news reporter, Marcus Mingo, as he talks about the current relationship between the San Marcos Police Department and Texas State students.
Police brutality is a controversial topic discussed amongst the world today. In 2014, the fire was reignited when an unarmed black man was shot dead by a white cop. 18-year-old Mike Brown was shot on August 9, 2014 by white police officer Darren Wilson in Ferguson, Missouri. Before the shooting, Brown robbed a convenience store of cigarillos and the police were called. Wilson was the officer dispatched and caught Brown walking down the street, fitting the store clerk's description. An altercation happened between Brown and Wilson and gunshots were fired. Wilson fired 12 shots towards Brown and killed him. On November 24, 2014, Wilson went to trial for the killing of Brown and was not indicted. When the city of Ferguson heard the jury's decision, the citizens responded with riots. All night, protesters tore down local businesses, burned down police cars, marched for hours, and destroyed the city of Ferguson. The San Marcos Police Department is making sure they keep a great relationship with their community after the deaths caused by police brutality. San Marcos Police Department Chief Chase Stapp says they have nothing to worry about because they make sure their officers are treating the community right on a daily basis.
It's about how you behave every day. It's not about focusing on, you know, one particular incident or anything like that, but it's about how the officers view their interaction with the public every day. We emphasize treating people with dignity and respect, and that's what we expect of the officers, and, you know, for the most part, that's what we see from our officers.
After the jury's decision not to indict Officer Wilson, minorities, especially African Americans, began to feel the justice system was not in favor of them. They felt their lives did not matter because every time a black life was lost, justice was not served. African Americans make up about 5% of the San Marcos population and are still a minority. But after all the controversy surrounding the treatment of blacks by police officers, Chief Stapp does not feel there is a disconnect within the San Marcos community.
I think things have changed for us in San Marcos in terms of the level of community support we have here, anything like that. I think people here get it. I really do believe if you treat people well, these kinds of issues, either they won't happen or when they do, people will see them for what they are and not paint with too broad of a brush.
Each officer carries weapons on them to protect themselves and the people around them. The most dangerous weapon officers carry is a gun, which is what killed Mike Brown. Some officers also carry weapons like nightsticks and tasers, but with the use of these weapons come necessary reasons. Chief Stapp talks about the criteria officers need to use such weapons.
A taser is an intermediate weapon, similar to a police baton. They're used when somebody is actively resisting arrest. When an officer is faced with somebody that's actively resisting arrest and not complying, they have to look at the entire situation to determine what's appropriate within that range. They consider things like their ability as compared to the perceived physical abilities of the offender. They look at the size disparity there, the apparent state of mind of the offender, whether or not they believe the offender's armed and things like that.
Staff says police brutality does not have to be officer versus offender. An unarmed person doesn't have to have a gun necessarily to be armed. Yeah.
Officers are allowed to use deadly force when they believe that that force is immediately necessary to either defend their own life or the life of a third person from imminent harm, a serious bodily harm or death. One of the things that people have a hard time understanding is how officers could use that level of force against somebody who doesn't have a physical weapon. The fact of the matter is, every officer that's in a situation brings certain weapons with them to an encounter because they carry them. If an officer is physically overpowered and, beaten to the point of unconsciousness by a person who's otherwise unarmed, now that person is armed. Police officers just are out there trying to do a job, and really what it boils down to is if people are compliant and do what officers ask them to do, there won't be issues like some of these that we've seen that have really made the media. Compliance is the key.
SMPD is continuing to protect the community by having their officers wear body cameras. SMPD started with these cameras before the incident in Ferguson, but Chief Stapp says they're not magic and will not necessarily make things better.
I don't think body cameras are any kind of a magic bullet. They will capture some things where we look back and we say, it's nice to have that video footage, but then at times they capture things, and because they're not, although they're visual, they can't capture perceptions. They can only capture visual snapshot of what happened. They can't capture what the officer perceived, felt, certain little nuances that, that only a human being can perceive. So we already have about a dozen in use. We have cameras in all of our cars. Those cameras, one of the components of those cameras is an audio recording or transmitting device that the officers wear on their uniform. So when they're in front of, within a pretty wide field of view in the front of their car, those cameras capture those encounters. And then when they're away from the the range of the video, the device still captures the audio. We got the body cameras for our officers who don't often work around their cars. So they may be away from their cars most of their shift. So we got the body cameras as a way to help augment their coverage.
Forum a few months after the Mike Brown case for San Marcos citizens where they discuss issues such as police brutality. The primary attendees were African Americans and the forum was held in a predominantly black church. This is a great example of how SMPD is keeping a good relationship with their community with all the controversy around police brutality. This allowed for the African American community to ask tough questions face-to-face in an open session. Like Chief Staff said, a face-to-face discussion is better than sitting behind a keyboard discussion. While SMPD continues to expand their community's support and trust, let's hope the city of Ferguson and other areas affected by police brutality can too.
Some interesting facts for you guys. February is the birth month of abolitionist and writer Frederick Douglass, and also President Abraham Lincoln. Also, countries around the world, including Canada and the UK, also devote the whole month to celebrating Black history. So I think that's a good thing to do. We should all be aware about Black history and all the events that went into gaining rights for African Americans.
So to give you guys some background information, it actually started as National Negro History Week by Carter G. Wilson back in 1926. February was chosen as the month for Black History Month or National Negro History Week, but it was because during the second week of February, on the 12th, you have Abraham Lincoln's birthday, and on the 14th, you have Frederick Douglass's birthday. And these two are clearly big figures in the African-American community. If you didn't know, former President Abraham Lincoln signed the Emancipation Proclamation on January 1st, 1863. And basically, the proclamation declared that all persons held as slaves within the rebellious states are and henceforward shall be free. This is where the tradition of Juneteenth comes from. Well, more in Texas because slaves in Texas did not get word about the freedom or the proclamation until really late, obviously. Not till June, about 6 months after the announcement was made. But here's a little more on the origins of Black history. National Negro History Week was proposed to be expanded in 1969 by the leaders of the Black United Students at Kent University. And then in 1976, at the U.S. Bicentennial, former President Gerald Ford officially recognized Black History Month and encouraged citizens to take the opportunity to honor the too often neglected accomplishments of Black Americans in every area of endeavor throughout our history. Keeping San Marcos in touch with its Black history is the Calaboose African Art Museum, which just reopened its doors, and we will send it over to our reporter, Ray Lianos.
Well, we thank you for days like this when we can come together to remember the things that you have done, remembering how things were and how things are, and noting the difference in how far you have brought us. We thank you for a community that comes together that's representative of different races and different ethnicities, that the diversity that is a part of San Marcos is shown in even this celebration of African-American history. We pray that this would be a place that people come to travel to learn their history. They come to San Marcos to get an education. Perhaps even when they come here, they can get an education on history. We love you. We thank you. We thank you for every family that's represented here today. We thank you for the goodness and the grace that you've already extended. And it would be in Christ's holy name that we do pray. Amen.
Thank you, Reverend Ben. Reverend Derek Ben was one of many who attended the grand reopening of the Calaboose African American History Museum in San Marcos on Sunday. Ben led the attendees with the convocation and was a guest speaker during the opening ceremony program. The Calaboose Museum had previously closed their doors in 2012 due to budget cuts and a much-needed renovation. There was not only African American history within the museum, but the building itself told its own story. The Calaboose Museum consists of two buildings. One part of the museum dates back to 1873, when it was used as Hays County's first jail. Then in 1943, the larger section of the building was built and became a USO club for Black soldiers who served during World War II. When the war ended, it became a community center and functioned as a cafe for Sammy Hardiman. When the building stopped being used, it began to fall apart, and the city announced plans to demolish it. Director of the museum, Elvin Holt, says that the founder of the Calaboose Museum, Johnny Armstead, stepped forward and decided the building should be preserved, and in 1990, the building became an official Texas Historic Landmark, which protected it from being torn apart. Holt also says that Armstead stepped forward to ensure it was on track to become recognized as a history museum.
In 1997, Mrs. Armstead went before the San Marcos City Council and petitioned for them to declare the building an African-American History Museum. And the City Council agreed with that. And in 1997, the Calaboose African-American History Museum was born.
A theme of the opening ceremony was to keep history alive. Reverend Ben made several biblical references and said that before Moses took the Israelites to the Promised Land, he gathered them together to rehearse in their hearing of history, and said there will come a generation that didn't know what God had done for his people and was disappointed that they would not know about Pharaoh, the Red Sea, or the trip to the Promised Land, but they could not be blamed because no one ever stopped to tell them, and he compares it to modern times.
There's an obligation, there's a responsibility that we have as citizens to teach those that are coming behind us. They will not know if we don't teach us. The sacrifices were not made for us to just casually take those and to keep moving. History is meant to be taught so that it does not repeat itself. And lastly, here's the thing. You'll never appreciate where you are if you haven't first realized where you come from.
The museum also featured exhibits and displays within it. Dana Smith, one of the first integrated African-American students at Texas State University, was in attendance for the grand reopening. Not only did Smith play an important role in history, but was able to provide historical artifacts for the museum's exhibits from her father, who was a furniture maker. Her father learned those skills at the Veterans Vocational Training School that operated in the 1940s and early 1950s in San Marcos. Acting Secretary for the Board, Shauna Brown, helped with some of the other exhibits in the museum as well. Brown was responsible for the education sector within the museum, which had old textbooks, teachers' gradebooks, and an original desk from the Colored School in San Marcos, which was functioning around 1912. The majority of the artifacts from the museum were either donated or things that founder Armstead collected. Another important attendee was Georgia Cheatham, who was also one of the first African-American students who integrated into Texas State University. Cheatham says that when she was attending Texas State University, she had no idea of the change she was creating.
I just wanted to go to school and get an education, so the historical value of it was not important to me and did not even occur to me until I was older and grown. Then I could see what a significant that it made a difference it made for blacks to be able to go to school here. But at the time, it wasn't important. Like I said, I guess I was just too young and I didn't really understand.
The Calaboose Museum promises to continue to preserve culture and history of the African American community for many generations to come.
Okay, thank you for that, Ray. And that brings us to the close of our very first show. Wait, this is my very first show on IPI. I'm proud of myself, me and Judith, but this comes to our close of our second show for the season so far this semester. Make sure y'all tune in next Sunday for Carmen and Mark. They'll be back in the studio again with you guys. So until then, you can keep up with us by following us on Twitter or Facebook at KTSW News. All right, see you guys later. Bye.